from days of long ago, from uncharted regions of the universe, comes a legend. The legend of Voltron, defender of the universe. A mighty robot, loved by good, feared by evil. As Voltron's legend grew, peace settled across the galaxy. On planet Earth, a galaxy alliance was formed. Together with the good planets of the solar system, they maintained peace throughout the universe. Until a new horrible menace threatened the galaxy. Voltron was needed once more. This is the story of the super force of space explorers. Specially trained and sent by the Alliance to bring back Voltron, defender of the universe. Voltron, defender
of the universe. Welcome, Voltron fans. What a fantastic time to be a fan of Voltron. There is so much to look forward to, including this podcast right here. Let's Voltron, the official Voltron podcast, has some super special guests with us today. Right, Greg?
That's right. Looking forward to it.
And ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, aliens and robots, my co-host, Greg Tyler.
Hey, thanks. I'm just glad you haven't fired me yet, Mark. This is only my second episode as co-host, and I'm having a blast, and I look forward to spending this episode and many more with you and Voltron fans around the world.
Well, I got to tell you, it's so fun having you as a co-host, Greg. Thanks for being here.
Thanks. Thank you.
Your contributions to the podcast are immeasurable, I got to tell you.
Well, thanks. I'm looking forward to taking this thing into the legendary Defender era and having us bounce our thoughts around about that show and, of course, shows of the past as well, as we'll be doing today.
It's certainly going to take our own internal Voltron force to keep this all together.
Yeah, I've been trying to get myself a Voltcom that will that I can use to generate some kind of super fan something to keep up with all the stuff that's going on. I don't know that I'll be able to do that, but with your help, Mark, I think we'll somehow trudge through this rebirth of Voltron and have a wonderful time doing it.
I agree completely. All right, we know it hasn't been very long since our last podcast. I'm sure you guys are really upset that you're getting two podcasts in like a week.
Bummer.
Yeah. But the last one, we talked to Jonathan Tchaikovsky about Trendmasters toys and prototypes. But since then, we've received some great feedback from people already talking about how they would have loved to get their hands on the Voltrek Cycles or Dracotron. And follow-up conversations even had us talking about a possible Sharknado-tron penned by Jonathan, where each pilot would have been in their own species of shark, like Keith would have been in the Great White, and then there would have been a Mako shark, Hammerhead, etc. I know you saw something of what he was showing there. Did you get to comment on it?
A bit. Enough to say that if they had actually shown this shark Voltron in Voltron the Third Dimension, would the show have really jumped the shark? I don't know.
I don't know, but...
I mean, would they have started the show with... Dun, 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 you know, I mean, sort of a hybridization of Jaws and Voltron. Who knows?
If we would have actually been able to get these toys out there, I think there would have been room for a Lion Force Voltron, a Vehicle Voltron, a Voltrex Voltron, a Stealth Voltron, a Dracotron Voltron. Why not a Sharknado-tron?
I'm still waiting for Garden Gnome Voltron. I mean, you know, and I'll form the elf hat, you know?
Yeah, well, what did we have as a April Fool's gift last year on ThinkGeek? It was the Cat Condo Voltron.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that was funny.
Yeah, so, well, we're sorry to say that there's been so little time since our last podcast, but... there hasn't been any new news about the Netflix show coming out later this year, Voltron Legendary Defender. So I'm sorry to say no new news.
Yeah, and I haven't heard anything new about, a brand new translation of Albagos into new Voltron shows either. That was a joke. but yeah, anyway, go ahead.
Yeah. So that was Jeremy's hope too, that, that we get Albegoss. But there is still more and more people finding out about it and talking about it on social media. So we encourage you to join with us on Twitter, at Let's Voltron, and on our Facebook page, Let's Voltron Podcast. There's also an Instagram account and a Pinterest account. Of course, all the episodes are on iTunes, Stitcher, through RSS, and on letsvoltron.com. By the way, Greg, the Voltron fans on Twitter have been asking, when are you going to join Twitter?
Oh, golly. I'm a Luddite with social media. I mean, I can't tell you how much time I actually waste on Facebook. I spend so much time there. If I were to adopt another social media site, I don't think I'd ever sleep. But we'll see. I mean, this podcast thing is a lot of fun. I'm really enjoying interacting with fans, and maybe I'll go from being a Twitter nitwit into a Twitter tweeter, if that makes sense. Anyway, we'll see.
Well, the one thing that really helps is the personal interactions that we have with the fans through this podcast and through social media. So for the rest of you, please share your personal Voltron experiences with us, and we'll share them on the podcast. Feel free to send us a note anytime by email at letsvoltronpodcast@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you. So I wanted to let those of you know out there who had reminded me that the ring that Wade Wilson picked up in Deadpool was the Han Solo ring that is available on Voltron.com right now, only as a pre-order. They have a shipment coming in late March.
Cool. Sorry, that's news to me too.
Yeah, it's sold out on HanCholo.com, and there's a few left on ThinkGeek.com, but make sure you check your sizes. Okay, I did finally get to see the movie and have verified it myself that was the ring. I still can't believe how cool it is that Deadpool is a Voltron fan. What do you think, Greg?
I've still not seen the movie, but I've got to do it. I've heard some really great things about it from various people in the real world and online. And the fact that Deadpool apparently likes to play with his Voltron toys in addition to taking out bad guys really makes me want to watch it even more. So great.
Yeah. And I can't wait to see if there are more Voltron references coming out in other things as we get closer to the release of Voltron Legendary Defender.
We'll see.
Everybody out there, keep a sharp eye and ear out for these references. Voltron fans, if you see them before we do, please let us know.
Voltron will be back after these messages. And now, back to Voltron, Defender of the Universe.
All right, so we're going to move on to our main event. What do you think there, Greg?
I'm excited.
Yeah, I'm excited too.
You know, I've been on the podcast several times as a guest and spoken with some really cool people, such as yourself, Mark, and of course, Shannon Weir and Tally and Mark Oliver and various other awesome people. But this is my first time talking with celebrities, and so I'm really looking forward to this.
Right, we're going to have two people on with us, and I'm going to give you the formal introduction treatment. How does that sound?
Formalize away.
Okay, are you ready?
Let's do it.
All right. I'd first like to introduce someone who has been a guest on the podcast previously. He had a lot to do with me getting all the facts straight for the Voltron book, Voltron from Days of Long Ago, a 30th anniversary celebration. Back when Michael French was my co-host, we interviewed him for podcast episodes 16 and 17. He was the supervising editor for Battle of the Planets, producer and director for Saber Rider and the Star Sheriffs, producer of Denver the Last Dinosaur, and director of Voltron, Defender of the Universe, and Fleet of Doom. We want to welcome back Franklin Kofod. Welcome, Franklin.
Thank you, Mark. It's good to hear you again.
Yeah, it's great to hear you, too.
It was nice seeing you at Comic-Con.
Yes, it was awesome seeing you at Comic-Con. This has become an annual thing, hasn't it?
It is. It's very convenient for me because both my daughters live down there and my grandson. So it's always good to have some excuse to go down there.
Yeah, I love Comic-Con in San Diego.
I don't want you thinking of yourself as an excuse so much, you know.
Okay.
As the new co-host, I want to just say this is a real thrill and honor to speak with you, Franklin. I very much enjoyed listening to the podcast episodes you were in, and I recall submitting some questions that Mark had asked of you. So it's a thrill to speak with you.
Great. I'm happy to be here. Thank you.
And Franklin, I want to thank you for getting in touch with your friend here who is here with us today. I have a long introduction ready for him. Are you ready?
We're ready. Before we get started, let me compress his ego.
Okay.
No, you've already done that. You just did that by listing off all the things that you produced that you never hired before. We'll talk about that later.
Okay. Well, Franklin directed our next guest for over 6 months and 125 episodes back in 84 and 85 for Voltron. Although some people would say he needs no introduction, I would not be doing him justice if I didn't set the stage for what this man has accomplished. So please bear with me, because we couldn't be more honored to have both of these gentlemen with us today. Jack Angel is the son of a Greek immigrant and learned quickly from observing the customers that would come into his father's grocery store that real-life people were the ones he liked to imitate, which led to his skills at telling jokes to keep people awake when he trained troops as an officer in the Korean War. After the war, he worked 18 years as a DJ, where he read billboards to get him ready to perform at 6 a.m. His first roles in voice acting came with the Super Friends at Hanna-Barbera, where he played Hawkman, the Flash, and Samurai, and where he first worked with Wally Burr, the celebrated voice director for many of the animated shows we loved in the 70s and 80s. That first animation role was 1977. Since then, after over 150 animated shows, movies, video games, commercials, narrations, and more, Jack Angel finds himself in the top 10 on the list of all-time box office grossing actors. Over $3 billion in box office receipts from Disney movies like Aladdin, Beauty and the Beast, Hercules, and Tarzan. Pixar movies like Toy Story, Monsters, Inc., A Bug's Life, and Cars, among many other movies that made kids and their families flock to the movie theaters. With the fantastic career that Jack has had in voice acting, he wrote a book to share what he's learned with aspiring voice actors titled How to Succeed in Voiceovers Without Ever Losing. And while he was at it, he published his own autobiography titled The Book of Jack, which details his life story from the perspective of his work with Steven Spielberg on artificial intelligence. Jack has said in interviews that his top three favorite roles are Teddy from Steven Spielberg's AI, Smokey the Bear, and the aforementioned Super Friends roles. Of course, everyone listening to Let's Voltron remembers the villainous roles of King Zarkon, Commander Cossack, Commander Urak, and Hazar from Voltron Defender of the Universe and Fleet of Doom. We'd like to welcome to the official Voltron podcast a man who refuses to call himself legend, although the numbers don't lie, who is also an enigma clothed in a conundrum, and the one and only voice maniac himself, Jack Angel.
Well, after that, what else should I say? There's nothing left.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that was quite an intro, Mark.
Yeah, I'm sorry. It was too long, wasn't it?
No, it's great. Perfect. I just, when you got to that part, but it needs no introduction. That's what they used to always say about Ella Fitzgerald.
Okay.
A lady who needs no introduction. So nobody knew who she was for years.
Jack, I just can't say enough about how great it is to have you and Franklin together here on Let's Voltron.
That was early in my voiceover career. I just came off of radio back then, and I just gotten married to the lady whose office we're in now. All of a sudden, we got this windfall of these 125 episodes of Voltron, and that in itself would have been enough. But Franklin convinced them that they shouldn't screw around with residuals. That was that they could get past that by giving everybody a 10-run buyout.
Well, the thing was that the concept, first of all, Copler Communications is, they own some television stations and that kind of thing. And Ted is a broadcaster. He's not a producer, or Ted Copler, I'm talking about. So his concept was that he was going to do these 125 episodes of these robot series, and the stations would like run them you know, forever in the morning, in the afternoon. So it would be like 10 runs or 10 broadcasts a week. And he envisioned like, you know, certainly more than 10 over the two year or 4 year, whatever the contract was for the show.
Right.
And of course, it was more popular even than anyone imagined. So it got run a lot more than that. So the concept was, maybe as it was sold to Ted, was that he never had to pay residuals. And so I have no idea how many times they ran, but I know they ran much more. Each episode ran many more than 10 times each, that's for sure.
Well, I don't know how often they ran, where they ran, but at the time, it was a lot of money. And everybody bought houses and cars and stuff like that. It was really a great windfall for us.
And did it lead to other projects that helped increase your careers?
Well, I already, I think, was doing some Transformers. I was 7 different characters on Transformers. And I already had done, as you mentioned before, Hawkman, the Flash, and Super Samurai at Hanna-Barbera. I did a lot of Marvel shows after that with Wally Burr. And I was a regular on Denver the Dinosaur.
Denver the Last Dinosaur, which we did also.
Yeah,
at,
a lot of episodes of that. So I was, you know, really busy doing all of that stuff, and then got into Disney, and had kind of never stopped working until I reached about 85 years old, and then it was sort of like, who needs an 85-year-old voiceover guy?
We do. We all would hire you in a heartbeat, Jack.
Yeah, well, it was. I've had a great time. From the time that I got out of college, even I had a great time in college, but I broke into radio as a disc jockey, and that was like stealing. I got to go play the music that I liked and tell jokes and do funny voices and work 3 hours a day and tell my neighbors who worked 8 hours a day, I am so tired, I had to go straight through with no lunch. 3 hours, can you imagine? And it was play. I comment now, I don't think I've ever worked in my life, because everything I've ever done was a lovely game where I got to play and get paid for it.
Very quickly, if you don't mind, I haven't met either of you before. I'm pretty new as a co-host to this podcast, but I want to say it is a real thrill to be speaking with both of you. So thank you very much.
It's only because you don't know us in person.
And it's a real thrill for me to be here with Jack.
All right. I had listened to a previous interview you conducted a couple of years ago with a fellow named John Bailey, and this was back in, I think, 2013. And one thing that I observed then and I'm observing now is that your voice sounds so much like it did in the 80s. You know, voices change over time. And
it's off and on now. You know, some days it's really good and some days it's terrible.
Well, you know, I remember I'm a huge fan of the Looney Tunes and Merry Melodies cartoons. And, you know, when you hear Mel Blanc in the 40s versus Mel Blanc in the 80s, the characters sound very, very different. And when I listened to you doing the Zarkon voice in that 2013 interview, and it just sounded almost exactly like I remember from the 80s. It's just phenomenal.
Well, unfortunately, those throat-ripping voices, they're much easier to do now that I'm older, because there's so much garbage in my throat naturally from doing all that stuff. You know,
you're blessed by the damage.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Speaking of which, your voice is your most important asset. You've been making money from it for about 60 years now. How do you keep it in good shape?
Oh, well, first off, it's an old disc jockey thing. I do pull-ups with my tongue. Nice. I don't know. You know, I was a smoker for years because it was really cool when you're 15 to be a smoker. And it stayed cool for a long time. And I smoked for 38 years. And unfortunately, those years when I was a disc jockey, the process is you light a cigarette, you cue up the records, you read the commercial, and then you sit back, listen to the music, and smoke. And then you put the cigarette in the ashtray, and you go through that process again and again and again for 3 or 4 hours. So you get a lot of firsthand smoke and a lot of secondhand smoke, and you go through like 2 or 3 packs a day. And so I think the lady who saved my life is my current wife, who said, when I asked her to marry me, she said, I can't live with a smoker. And I'd already tried to quit several times with smoke enders and Stop for Life and hypnosis and cold turkey and cold turkey and cold turkey. And finally, I found someone, a doctor, who would put a staple in my ear. And when you want the cigarette, that indicates that you're under a little bit of stress. So you press the staple, which releases endorphins from your brain, and you mellow out, and you don't need a cigarette. So I was down one cigarette a day. And back then, though, it was 34 years ago, smokers had a lot of rights and non-smokers didn't. The tables obviously have turned since then, but people would say, you smoke, bothers me, and I would tell them where they could go.
Did you use one of your throat ripper voices to tell them where to go?
I'd be a Zarkon.
Who do you think you're talking to, swine?
Was there ever a time you lost your voice?
No. There was a time when I was a disc jockey when I quit smoking and I couldn't find the voices because apparently my vocal cords weren't corroded with whatever the hell I was getting from the cigarettes. And as I tried to manipulate my throat into a particular voice, I couldn't find it. And that scared the hell out of me. So I started smoking again.
Wow.
It's wonderful how your mind comes to save you in moments of dire stress.
So out of all the voice directors that you've worked with, which is the one that cared most about not hurting your voice?
None of them. No, they don't care.
Oh, wow.
I mean, they got a product. They have to get it done. You came in, you auditioned for it, and you know it's a throat ripper. And in fact, when I was younger, I'd meet these older guys who had been around a lot and had done some animation, and they wouldn't go out for the tough voice scrapers. And I would say, well, I will. And so I'd go out and do it. And then as I got older, I realized I'm paying the penalty for it, you know. But I wouldn't change anything. It was all great fun.
You had written two books in 2012, How to Succeed in Voiceovers Without Ever Losing, and your autobiography, The Book of Jack.
Uh-huh.
How do you write two books in 1 year?
You sit at your computer and you write.
I have to tell you, I had I learned that you had written those books just 2 days ago, and I would have dived into them by this point. I just didn't have enough time to do so, but I will be buying them both this week.
Actually, it took several years of writing The Book of Jack. That took a lot longer than How to Succeed in Voiceovers Without Ever Losing, and I actually published that one first. It's a smaller book. And the genesis of that was that there are a lot of people who say, oh, gee, being in this business, there's such rejection. And I'd say, wait a minute, there's no rejection. Unless you're drunk and disorderly and all that stuff. But mostly the game isn't one of rejection. The game is selection. So if we're going to choose, say, Santa Claus, we ask... if we're the agency, we say that to the talent agent, send us 10 of your best Santa Clauses. So all these fat guys with beards come in, and we can only hire one. So we have him go through his dog and pony show, and given what we want on that day, we choose one. And so he's the winner, and the other, however many, go away and say, I got rejected. But they didn't get rejected. They actually... and they got validated as one of the best. You don't ask for send me several not so good people. You say send me the best. So they were the best that day, and they go home and say I got rejected. They made it up. Not true.
I would never have thought of that. Great perspective.
I just might interject something here. Back in the 80s, I had was having lunch with Neil Ross probably sometime in early in the year, and we were talking about, I was asking him, you know, how he got jobs and auditions and one thing and another. And he said, I figured it out that last year I got one job for every 14 auditions. So what I need to do is audition more.
Right.
That's right.
Right.
Well, I think I wrote in the Book of Jack, I used the number 10. And I said, you audition 10 times, you get one. So now you got a ratio, 1 out of 10. So the faster you get through the other nine that aren't yours, the faster you get to the next one, the next group of 10 that is yours, and they don't fall in that order. And then there are ways of expanding your abilities so that when you audition, you cut that ratio down from 1 out of 10 to 1 out of 9, 1 out of 8, 1 out of 7, or whatever. So doing it free as an audition is the one that gets you the work.
So I have to ask you, Jack, if you're auditioning for a particular role and you are, I mean, you are a man of many voices, if you're approaching a given role, do you normally get a few shots to try different approaches to the same role that you're trying out for, or you just have to pick one and hope that, that it's good enough? I mean, you know what I mean? If you have a character, whoever it is, and you have the option, you could say, gee, I can think of three different ways to deliver this and sell this character. You know, do you get one shot to pick a voice, or do you get a chance to try a few?
Sometimes you do and sometimes you don't. Lenny Weinrib, who was a master of so many great voices.
And Hunk.
Yeah, he was Hunk. When he'd go into audition, he would leave them a half a dozen of, you know, they could do with whatever they wanted with them, but he would do his whole dog and pony show.
Huh. Yeah, well, I remember when we talked to Franklin earlier that we had said that Lenny always wanted to do the extra takes.
At the end of Lenny's lines, he'd say, now that I'm at the end, I want to go back and do, you know, half a dozen lines over because I have a better idea or I understand better what's going on or whatever. And 80% of the people would be, you know, say, I'm done, I'm gone.
All right. So in your book, How to Succeed in Voiceovers, you give great advice about voice acting. How important is it as a voice actor to pass on what you've learned?
It's not important at all.
No, you want the least competition you can get.
Okay. You know, I tell young guys that, you know, say, well, how do I make a demo tape? And I say, you sit down and you go to ArleneThornton.com because that's my agency. I mean, my wife's agency.
Yep.
And you click on the voice actors and you listen to the demo tapes that they made. And you particularly if you're talking about animation, some of the best animation performers in the world are at this agency and they all have demo tapes. And so you hear the guy's regular voice and then you hear that he went here and he went here. And, you know, he did all kinds of variations with his throat. And so now it's like I used to listen to the comedy albums when I was a disc jockey. And these guys they have their natural voice and then they would do something. And I learned to do a lot of the voices that I do from listening to other voice guys. Think of Humphrey Bogart. He had almost a frozen bottom lip, and his voice was deeper, and he says, we'll always have Paris, sweetheart. And so I heard guys doing that, and oh, that's how you do it. Because you listen to what his regular voice is like, and then what he's doing. So obviously, he's doing something to get that characterization. And then it's a matter of, you know, one of the things that one of the famous voice directors at Warner Brothers said, Andrea Romano.
Oh, yes.
Yes.
Andrea says, I don't care how good you are at doing a particular voice. If you can't act, you're of no value to me.
Right. That makes sense.
So she tells them all to take acting classes. And I already did that. So before I got to here. So, you know.
Yeah, well, there's other people out there that are really good voice actors, like D. Bradley Baker.
Yeah.
He's got a website dedicated to teaching people how to get into voice acting. And then Bob Bergen has his own training classes and everything that he has people go to learn how to do voices.
Yeah.
And then you know that John DiMaggio did the documentary on voice acting called I Know That Voice.
Yeah, I'm in that documentary.
Right. What was it like to be in that documentary?
I don't know. They just, for me, it was a couple of short interviews, and I'm in a documentary. It was mostly D. Bradley Baker and two or three other guys who were the primary guys around whom they did the documentary, and they never had Frank Welker in there. They couldn't get Frank. He just won't do stuff like that. And he's the best voice actor in the city, you know?
Right.
So nobody has done as many roles as Frank, and nobody's done any of them as good as Frank. I think he's the best I ever heard. He had on his license plate 13 ducks. And the reason is he does an imitation of Donald Duck. And then, can you do Donald Duck? Yeah, that, right.
Wow.
And then he says, and then he changes it. So instead of going, he magnifies it. So it's 13 ducks singing, "We Wish You a Merry Christmas."
Oh, my. I would love to hear that.
And it's amazing. I was in Balto with him. We did Balto in England, and with thank you, Mr. Spielberg. And I was a sled dog. I was Nicky the dog would talk like this, and Frank was all the wolves, and the main wolf, and he does a dog and cat fight, that's just amazing.
I love, and I, at the risk of this turning into a Frank Welker, you know, kind of a fan thing, I love the humanity that he breathes into these animal characters. I know my daughter is really into Curious George on PBS Kids, and that's a more anthropomorphized character, but just the straight animals come across with such humanity. It's just amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, he's a pretty crazy guy.
Frank auditioned for Denver, The Last Dinosaur, and he was awesome. And in the end, powers that be, chose Pat Fraley, who did a really good job and was really good.
Okay. There's that selection again.
Yeah.
You mentioned Bob Bergen teaching classes. Because my wife is a talent agent and in her specialty is voice and animation, he invited her to go to his class one night. And so I joined him, and I was amazed at how good the talent was in the class. And I asked them, you know, were you this good when you first got here? And they said, no. So apparently he's a wonderful teacher. And I would recommend, based on that experience, I'd recommend him highly if there are young guys who and girls who want to strengthen their animation characterizations.
Right.
Well,
that's a great stamp of approval right there. So I want to go back to your book of Jack, too. Is that okay?
Yeah.
All right. I like the perspective you wrote that book. Everything sort of revolves around the work that you did with Steven Spielberg. And you said that he reminded you of your father. Is that why you wrote it that way?
No. I had written the book differently. It was going to be titled The Son of a Bean King. My father was an immigrant from Greece. He lived on the island of Crete. And he came to this country by mistake, actually. His brother had sent money for his wife to come. And at the 11th hour, she backed out. She was afraid to go. And he was 17, and he said, I'll go. And so he got to come to this country. He was always told the streets were paved with gold, and when he got to New York, he kept looking for the gold. And it wasn't there, of course. And then he went to the coal mines in Pennsylvania and made some money and came to the San Joaquin Valley here in California and helped build his own house and had a bean farm. And he and his brothers worked it, and they had a contract with the Army to supply beans. And In the old country, respect for the elders was paramount. So that, and he was the youngest of the brothers, and so his older brother said, hold out for a better price, hold out. And the beans rotted, and he realized that he was living with people who didn't know what the hell they were doing, and so he just left. But during the time that he grew, he used to say, I was the bean king. And, you know, when you're a little kid, you go, boy, my dad was the bean king. And then you get to be a teenager, and you don't believe anything your father ever said. And when I broke into radio, it was in Merced, California, which is the county seat where he got his citizenship papers. And I walked into a store to get a pack of cigarettes before my show, and there were people are talking Greek. And so I said, Tikanis. And they said, come out, you Greek. And I said, yeah. And that was about the extent of my knowledge of the Greek language. So I quickly switched to English. And I said, yeah. As a matter of fact, my father got his citizenship papers here 30 years ago. And an old man on the back said, who's your father? And I said, John Angel. He said, John Angel, the Bean King? Oh, my God. He really was the Bean King.
Wow. So I called
him and I apologize for ever doubting him.
Yeah. Oh, could you please do me the favor of telling the story of when you were working as a DJ and you had the golf show that you did on the radio with Bob Blackburn and the 18th with Nicholas and Palmer and Player and Trevino?
Well, I was the only guy at the station that didn't play golf. And so I was the guy that had to stay back at the station. And first off, golf is bad enough on television. But golf on radio?
Oh, and wow.
It was like, boy, how deathly can you get? But I must say, they did a good job, technically. Everybody had headsets, and they were all plugged into portable radios, and they just took their cues off of the radio. So I would say, okay, let's throw it to Mark. He's on the 15th green, and you would hear that, and you'd say, okay, this is Mark on the 15th green, and you go on the thing. So I realized they were all connected to one another, and I was back fuming because they were ruining my disc jockey show by doing a stupid golf game. But Arnold Palmer and Jack Nicklaus and Gary Player and the Mexican guy.
Lee Trevino.
Yeah. Yeah, that Mexican guy. Sorry.
Yeah.
And in L.A. he says that, my God.
Yeah.
So anyway, they're on the 18th green. And I noticed earlier that when a jet plane went over, of course, it made so much noise, the guys had to yell. So I went back and got a sound effect of a jet plane.
Nice.
And I played it on the air, knowing that they would hear it through their headsets. And right at the critical moment, Blackburn was saying, now Gary Player addresses the ball, and he's raising his voice to compete with the noise in his ear, and he's looking around, and everybody's looking at him like he's nuts. And he took the headset off, and he said, I think I'm the victim of a practical joke. And it was worth it to be there all day just for that.
That is awesome.
I believe it.
The one other thing that I did made me famous in Portland was some lady called and she said, my husband and I are due at a party and he's stuck in traffic and come on, help me get him home. Come on, do something. And I said, I can do something. And I went back and I got the sound effect of a siren. And I told the listeners, I said, okay, well, here's the deal. This guy's caught in traffic and I'm going to get him home. And in order to do that, I got to get you all home. So roll down the window in your car and turn your radio up as loud as you can get it. And then I played the siren. So every car listening became a cop's car. And the people who weren't listening would hear that siren and pull over. And the people who heard the siren knew it was me, and they were laughing so hard they had to pull over. So the next night I was at a party, and the district attorney said, boy, you are really stupid, aren't you? And I said, why? That's nothing. He and I graduated from San Francisco State at the same time, so he took that license to call me stupid. And I said, what are you talking about? And he said, that was a really dumb thing you did. And he said, you could have caused a lot of problems. And I said, did I? And he said, no, and you're damn lucky you didn't. And I suppose I was, but boy, it was fun.
The fun that you obviously had on the radio, which would you say you preferred having done, radio work as a disc jockey or voice acting?
After I was in radio for a while, I got to know pretty much how you run a successful radio station. And when I worked for stations and managers who didn't know as much as I did, I would begin to tell them. And you can know more. And if you keep your mouth shut, you get to keep your job. If you keep telling people how to run their radio station, when it's their turn to be boss, they don't like that, and they fire your ass. I got fired quite a few times near the end. And the last time, I really didn't see it coming, although I had obviously set it up a year before. So I was fired from KFI, the biggest radio station on the West Coast. So there I was, out of a job. I'd already worked at KMPC and KISS AM and one tour at KFI, and this was the second tour at KFI, and there were no other stations I wanted to work at. So I said, okay, I'll just concentrate on voiceovers. And so I began to promote myself and get really good jobs. And 2 years later, I said, man, am I glad they fired me from KFI. Because now I was making twice as much money as I'd ever made in radio. I didn't have to go to meetings and have some guy who could never do it tell me I was doing it wrong. And I got all the holidays and weekends off, which I never got for 18 years. So it was really living. And it was a great turnaround for me. And, you know, there are no negatives. So, I mean, that just further establishes that I was right about that.
Great.
Well, one of the things that, you know, Jack, obviously was used to working shifts, you know, and being someplace for a few hours to do whatever. And so Jack would have a, you know, an audition or a job or something. And then after the job, he would just sit in a lobby and talk to people, you know, other actors coming in and, you know, whoever else. So he's sitting around one afternoon. Some guy is supposed to come in and read the line, Anheuser-Busch, St. Louis, Missouri. So the guy doesn't show up. So Jack is sitting there, and they say, hey, Jack, come in and read this. So Jack goes in and read it. And how long did they run with that? Just
well, they tagged it on all their radio spots for 2 years. And I made $18,000 just from those tags.
Wow.
And that I was an afterthought. You know, if the guy had showed up, somebody else would have done it.
Right time, right place.
Yeah.
I recall another time where you had a problem saying Boston Red Sox.
Yes. I was directing the news in Reno and also on a TV station. And also I would do the weather, and every once in a while the sports director wouldn't show up, or, you know, and so I would do the sports. And I wanted to be a good little television announcer and look at the screen, not the copy. And I was giving the ball scores. And I said, and the Cleveland Indians beat the Boston Red Sox. And if I had just kept going, it would have been okay. But I stopped. And I said, that's Red Sox. And then everybody just went, you know. And here the guys laughing in the sealed-off control room.
Oh.
And so... then the next thing, I turn the copy over, and here's the kicker, the funny story in sports. So I said, okay, it's time for the funny story in sports. We're going to have two tonight. And then I went. And they cut to black and, you know, whatever. The following day, as the fates would have it, I was doing a live remote from a model home. You know, you do what you have to do in small markets. And
right.
So the way it was, the disc jockey would cut in, okay, let's go to Jack at the model home. And I would say, yeah, yeah, and do a commercial about how great the house is. And an old lady and her husband walked in, and she looked at me and she said, I know you. You're a Boston Red Sox.
Oh, man.
I'm a news director. I do the weather. I'm a disc jockey. And all that stuff. And what am I known for? Boston Red Sox.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Okay.
I got to ask, since you're both in the room and both were heavily involved in producing Voltron, 125 episodes in 6 months.
No.
What a pace. How in the world? What kind of a schedule? I mean, how do you do that with a half dozen actors and, you know, and Jack specifically, you know, when you came in, did you read lines for a single episode and then come back however many days later and do your lines for the next one? Or did you do them, you know, a few episodes at a time?
No, I get a call from my agent. Okay, you're doing Voltron today. And I'd go in, and Frank was there with the script. The lines were already done in Japanese. So Frank's company... I don't know who was it. You?
Well, we rewrote the show.
They rewrote the entire show.
Jameson Brewer and Mark.
And they
Mark
so you know, I rule the universe. That's 3 seconds. Do it. I rule the universe. Now that was four. Do it in three. I rule the universe. Now that was 2.5. Do it in three. I rule the universe. Okay, that was good. Move on to the next one. And without seeing picture, without knowing what it was about, I would just do my lines. Nobody else in the room but Frank and me and the engineer.
Gary.
Frank had the timings, and he had to know what the action was so that he'd know how much force to be in the voice, how much whatever. Because it wasn't always I ruled the universe. There were other things that he said. So Franklin had to know the storyline and how much force or less force to be. And so we'd go through all of my lines, and we did a whole episode in, what, 40 minutes?
Yeah, 20 to 40 minutes, I guess, for each actor.
And then the next actor would go in and do theirs, and somebody would glue it all together. So we did all those in 6 months.
No, we didn't do them in 6 months. Well, I liked the story, but, it wasn't anything like that. But we probably did record. You probably worked 4 days a week, didn't you?
Something like that.
Yeah. So he probably did 4 sessions a week, you know, recording lines. So let's see, that's 4 times 6 months is 26 weeks. So that's 80. Once we got moving, we were probably recording 4 shows a week, but that probably tapered off. And then, of course, that was only the first 104. And then the other 20, whatever it was, 22, 23, were done the following year and, to original animation.
Which means you didn't have a stopwatch on those, right?
We didn't have a stopwatch on those, no. We recorded those. We might have recorded them ensemble, too. I'm not, I don't remember that, but I don't remember that specifically.
I don't either.
So what was it like when Michael Bell and Neil Ross and Peter Cullen and Jack and BJ got together with Lenny? What was that like when they all got together?
No, they didn't get together in the lobby.
They would get together in a lobby, but I would be there. We would probably record. I think we recorded in the afternoon.
Yeah.
And so I'd have the studio for like 4 or 5 hours, like 1 to 6, let's say. And based on how long I thought their lines, would take for them to record their lines, I'd book somebody 1 and somebody 1/4 to 2 and somebody 3 and whatever.
So they just crossed in the halls.
And they spent a lot of time in the green room.
Okay.
But they're all done individually.
Okay. So I'm actually curious about Voltron the Third Dimension, made in the late 90s. It featured Neil Ross, Michael Bell, and BJ Ward from the 80s show. Did anybody ever call you, Jack, and say, hey, Zarkon's still around. You want to play him?
Nobody ever did that.
Nobody ever called me either.
The guy who played the role in the 90s was Kevin Michael Richardson. Have you ever had the opportunity to work with him? I'm just curious.
Yeah, he's a big black guy.
Okay.
His voice is mine to the fourth power down, deep. And so I see him in the lobby. I say, hey, how you doing, baby? But he talks that way all the time.
And so I was also curious, Franklin, about the Go Lion Die Rugger, the first 104 episodes versus the last 20. Were those episodes storyboarded to your knowledge domestically and then sent overseas to be animated, or how much, what was the order there? How much control did the folks in the U.S. have over those episodes?
They were written here. And I don't think we boarded them, but we did do, some key drawings, of things that we wanted.
Oh, okay.
But it was mostly produced. I mean, they had produced the show. Who was it that produced it?
Was it Toei?
Toei, yeah. Okay. They had produced it, and we'd had a lot of conversations with them, and, we wanted to continue on with the same theme and the same look.
Okay.
So, it wasn't like we were starting something from scratch.
Okay. And then when that last batch of 20 episodes coupled with Fleet of Doom, when that came down the pipeline, which came first? Was it Fleet of Doom and then the last 20, or was it the other way around?
The Fleet of Doom, I believe, were the last 2 shows.
Okay. All right. I was just curious. Okay.
And we engineered that to either be a standalone hour or 2 half hours.
Oh, okay. Great. And Jack, heroes or villains? Do you have a preference? Who do you prefer to play, and why? Heroes versus villains.
I don't know. I had fun doing Hawkman, the Flash, and Super Samurai over at Hanna-Barbera when I first broke into animation, and that was fun, and had fun with doing what we did together on Voltron. I did a lot of episodes of Transformers, and that was great fun. I had a great time no matter what. And you never knew what was, it's like going back to Welker, when we recorded Transformers, it was at Wally Burr's studio, and they had a sliding door that went shh, shh when you came in. And Frank could do the door. So we'd be sitting around the table, and all of a sudden we'd hear the door open and look over, and there'd be nobody there because it was Frank.
Amazing.
That's great.
Do you have a favorite character, a single character that you that stands out among any of the others? Characters that you have played, or maybe characters you would have liked to have played?
Well, there's a lot of them I would have liked playing. I think I have to go with Teddy on AI, artificial intelligence.
Yeah.
Largely because it was a major role in a really major motion picture, which didn't do as well as everybody thought it would do. But it was a Steven Spielberg movie, and he said, I want you on the set every day, whether you got lines or not. When I want to make a change, I want to make a change. So I was on the set for the 3 months that they did the shooting and had not much time, much anything to do but schmooze with Jude Law and some of the other guys on the set. So it was great. I mean, I loved it. So I have to validate that as a, and I, it wasn't a difficult voice. It was just sort of me as a teddy bear.
Can we hear I Am Not a Toy once?
I am not a toy. I'm a robot. Yeah.
Thank you.
I love the quality of your voice. You have a very distinctive, dare I say, kind of a gravelly quality that I've always admired in the various roles you've played, whether it's, you know, big bads like Zarkon and Urak and Hazar, or the kinder, gentler characters like Ultra Magnus. I've always admired that quality in your voice.
Well, thank you.
And there's a warmth to it.
Yes, yeah. There is.
Uh-huh. Do I sound like Robert Stack?
Sometimes.
I have to tell you, I was a kid when Transformers was out, and I wasn't allowed to watch the movie because my folks said, you know, you're able to watch it on TV for free. We're not going to pay to have you watch it on a big screen. So I heard your voice as Ultra Magnus before I ever heard Robert Stack. And every time I hear the movie, it always sounds wrong to me because you're not doing Ultra Magnus.
You know, when I was a little kid, there was no television. There was just radio. And the Lone Ranger, the guy that played the Lone Ranger, had a big, beautiful voice, much like Gage's voice. He was killed in an automobile crash. So they had a dilemma. They had a couple of guys who had deep voices, but the throatiness of it was different. And people were more acutely aware of had to make the distinction of who was whom of those radio voices because there was no body to look at, you know?
Right.
So they did a thing where the Lone Ranger got shot and he was in a cave and Tonto, his faithful Indian companion, was taking care of him. And Tonto did all the stuff in the episode. He'd go out and shoot people and shoot guns out of their hands like the Lone Ranger did. And he would say, yes, Tonto. Yes, go shoot them, whatever he said. And then gradually he'd get better and stronger. And as he got better and stronger, that voice then became the new Lone Ranger voice. But I always knew that was the wrong guy because that guy had always played bad guys because he had a big, hairy voice. Huh. Once you have the pictures, the videos just so overpower the voice that it almost doesn't matter anymore.
Oh, I have to disagree only because, you know, I listen very closely to vocal performances in animated productions and
you're a freak.
Well, that's true. Thank you for noticing. I've been called a freak by Jack Angel. Amazing.
Wear that with pride.
Yeah, well,
I do.
we all do this stuff because we're freaky or lazy. I used to want to be the second Salvador Dali, and I was an artist in high school, and so I got a book somebody gave me as a gift of pictures of Salvador Dali, and in the cover there's a story about a different artist, and they show the intricacies of some of the stuff he did, and the line was, "No masterpiece was ever created by a lazy artist," and I thought, "Oh God, I'm doomed."
So there's a new show coming out later this year on Netflix called Voltron Legendary Defender. It's made by DreamWorks Animation, and it's going worldwide on Netflix, the biggest ever audience for Voltron. So what do you guys think about the new show, and what do you think it'll take for this show to do well?
Well, I don't know much about it. I would certainly like them to remain true to, you know, to the original. I don't know too much about it other than the couple of things I've read on the internet. And I listened to a podcast where you talked about it the other day. I don't know if it was the latest podcast or not. And that's about all I know about it.
Well, is it live action or is it animation?
It's animation. Did you ever hear of the show The Legend of Korra?
No.
All right. Well, it's supposed to be sort of in the same animation style as Legend of Korra.
I need to look that up now. I've never seen it myself.
That's what I've heard.
Huh, okay.
But as far as I know, it's a TV show, so it's going to be on Netflix, and they'll probably drop 13 episodes at a shot. So as soon as we get it later this year, we'll get to see the first 13 episodes.
Cool.
I do recall that you did challenge Samuel L. Jackson to an acting off or a voice off with Frank Welker. Did that ever happen?
No.
No.
No, should we tell people what that's about?
Yeah, go ahead.
There's a website. It lists all the movies that generated a whole lot of money and who was in the movies. And at one time, Welker was number one. There was nobody who was going to ever catch Welker. Number two was Tom Cruise, and then number three was Tom Hanks. And I was number four in the category of $100 million movies. So Samuel L. Jackson goes on Howard Stern's radio show, and he's so proud that he just knocked me off, and he's number four now on that list. And so he's talking about it with Howard Stern. And Stern says, well, wait a minute, who's Welker and who's Angel? And he says, oh, those aren't real actors. They're voiceover guys.
And
now I'm at Comic-Con, and we're in a room with about 1,000 people who came to see voice actors not act, apparently. somebody brought up that website. So as long as somebody else brought it up, I said, well, I'll tell you the story. And I told them about Samuel L. Jackson. And everybody booed when I said, they're not real actors, they're voiceover actors. So I took that opportunity to challenge him out in the world, saying, Mr. Jackson, I challenge you to come to a studio of your choice anywhere with Frank Welker and me, and we will see who the real actor is.
Mm-hmm.
And I did it twice, another venue, but he never responded.
Wow. All right, well... We're gonna wrap this whole thing up with a nice little scene that we put together for the podcast.
Okay.
You guys have the papers, right?
We do.
What I'm gonna do is I'm gonna have just Franklin do what he did 30 years ago, and I'm gonna let him take the reins from here on out, and I'm gonna have him direct you in the scene. Franklin's gonna have to do the voice of Hagar.
Okay.
It can be changed.
Okay.
Go, Franklin, go.
This is for all the Voltron fans out there who wanted to see a behind-the-scenes look at Franklin Kofod directing Jack Angel as Zarkon and as Urak. Go ahead, Franklin.
So, Jack.
Yes, sir, Frank, Master.
So we got this little thing we want, a little audition thing we want to do here.
Uh-huh.
Okay, if you take a little time.
And look at it. Do you have a voice that might sound like this guy you did back in the 80s?
Zarkon.
Yes, he was like...
No,
I don't think
that was the guy.
Oh, okay, I got it.
Okay. Take 122.
King Zarkon is in his throne room on planet Doom. Hagar and Commander Yurek are also there.
Hagar, have you devised an evil plan for getting me on Lex Voltron?
Yes, my lord. I'm using my magic to make every Voltron fan on Earth bow to your wishes. They will no longer follow that blubbering Voltron. I will follow you.
I love the way your twisted mind works, you old witch.
Shall I have your ship prepared, my king?
No need, Yurek, you idiot. I can do this all over Skype. No need, you idiot. I can do this all over Skype. Listen and listen well, faithful Voltron fans. Your days of following that feline fruitcake are over. He will never give you what you can. There's two wills in here.
Sorry.
Yeah, boy. Can I just pick it up?
Yeah.
Listen and listen well, faithful Voltron fans. Your days of following that feline fruitcake are over. He will never give you what I can provide. With my rule, you will finally get that precious live-action movie you have all desperately longed for. Join me, and we can rule the galaxy together. From now on, you will all say, Lex Zarkon!
How did that sound, Franklin?
Sounded great.
It sounded great to me, too.
Did that all get over there okay?
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah, we got all that.
All right.
Did you hear it good, Greg?
I did, and I was going to say, as far as Hal Jack did, I would not dare criticize the King of Planet Doom.
Oh, man.
Thank you.
I have to tell you, talking with you guys has been an absolute blast. So thank you so much. As a fan who only recently turned co-host, this has just been a real honor.
Yeah, and I want to thank both of you guys for joining us on Let's Voltron, the official Voltron podcast. You guys are welcome back anytime. I had a blast too.
Good. So did we.
Well, great, it's great,
nice
great.
Seeing Franklin, after all these years.
Yeah, it's nice. Nice getting to see Jack.
Franklin still has a beard. He came to my 55th birthday party, and he gave me a giant Voltron, which was about 3 feet high.
Yeah, the metal one. Yeah.
Standing on a little podium, and an engraving was, "To Jack Angel, where would Voltron be without Jack Angel, the meanest son of a bitch in the universe?"
That's nice. Awesome.
Yeah. So well, that sits in my office.
That's great. It's probably worth a mint.
Maybe.
Wow.
Just because I've touched it.
Yes.
Well, of course.
I played with it.
Voltron will be back after these messages. And now, back to Voltron, Defender of the Universe.
Wow, that was a blast, wasn't it, Greg?
It was. You know, the only thing I forgot to ask was to ask Jack Angel if he's glad that Hazar didn't die in Voltron as he did in Die Rugger. But I'm kidding.
At this point, 30 years later, he probably doesn't care.
Yeah, no doubt, no doubt. Yeah. Just, you know, Hazar who? What?
Yeah.
Hay fever? What? Wow, what a blast. And I have to tell you, as a listener to the previous interview that you and Michael French had done with Franklin Kofod, I could talk with either of them for hours, boring either of them to tears, I'm sure. But it's such a neat thing to chat with folks who actually worked on the show that we still admire over three decades later. Amazing.
And I have to tell you, as the guy who had to go through and write the introduction to the Voltron book, I interviewed all these people, but when I was interviewing them, they were telling me all these great stories, right? And I went to the editor and I said, I'd like to tell the stories. And that she said that wasn't really what it was about.
Yeah.
It was about just the facts, you know, and right. telling the story of how Voltron was developed and everything. Huh. Because if I had the chance to tell all these stories, it would be a completely other book.
Yeah, it would have been a fun one. Although the book as it is really cool. I was just browsing it yesterday and thinking, wow, this, it's such a cool read, and your introduction is a key part of that. So,
yeah, so it's interesting to see what the process is of writing a book, but there are great stories out there, and that's why we have this podcast, so that we can share those great stories with everybody and have great guests on like Jack Angel and Franklin Kofod.
This podcast has grown in terms of the kinds of folks that you've been able to talk with, and now I've been able to talk with, you know, Ted Koppler, Bob Koppler, Neil Ross, Franklin Kofod, John Teichman, Mark Handler, the list goes on and on and on, and wow, what a thrill.
Giles Panton.
Oh, yes, yes, yeah. Of course.
Hopefully, you know, with the new show coming out and everything, we get to talk to all the people involved with that show as well.
Yeah, and even if we don't, I think we will, but even if we don't, wow, what a great shot at just talking with fans about a show that's still in production. You know, the Voltron.com forums were a really hopping place back in 2011, 2012, when Voltron Force was being shown. Jeremy Corey, at World Events Productions, was very interactive with the fans there and on social media, and it really kind of added a new dimension, dare I say, third dimension, no. But it really made the show even more fun to watch than it was on its own. And maybe this podcast can provide some of that with Voltron Legendary Defender. We'll see.
Right, right. There is one thing that I wanted to point out, that in our last podcast, we talked about how New York Toy Fair had announced that Playmates Toys would be the one releasing the toy line for Voltron Legendary Defender in spring of 2017. And you could see that at their booth. It was all painted on the side of the wall there.
Mm-hmm.
But there was another booth at New York Toy Fair that we didn't talk about, but has always been there and has always been there at the Comic-Cons, and that's Toynami.
Yes. Yes, we saw an uncolored test shot or prototype of this at prior shows. We saw a full color version at New York Toy Fair, and that's the Voltron Ultimate EX, which I believe is going to stand some 18 inches tall with super articulated lions that can actually sit down. It's a much more stylized version of our favorite lion-based Defender of the Universe, and it looks really cool. It pops in color. Looks great.
Yeah, I got to say, it did look great. I was able to see some images out there on Facebook, because there's a Voltron collectors group that was sharing those.
Yes.
And then as well, there was somebody who shared with the podcast. If you go out on the podcast page, he shared the video of the Toynami booth. So we'll share those again on the podcast page for this podcast on letsvoltron.com. But if you don't want to wait, you can just go right out to the Facebook page.
Love it.
I think we have to end this a little bit differently than we end most podcasts, because we had a certain somebody.
Yes.
On the podcast, a very villainous character.
I'm still shaking in my shoes just thinking about it.
Called King Zarkon. And we actually had Jack Angel work out a scene with Franklin Kofod. So that was awesome.
Yeah, and you know, almost as awesome was Franklin's delivery of Hagar. That was something too.
So with all that going on, I think we're going to say, until next time,
let's Zarkon!